The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. Good afternoon. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. We've got a great show set up for you here. We've got a lot of great topics. First thing we're going to talk about, though, is religious liberty in the private sector, and maybe not so much even religious liberty as just viewpoint diversity. There's a lot of news out there about corporate activism, employee activism within corporations. We're going to talk a little bit about ESG. We'll talk a little bit about what ESG actually is. But we're going to talk about this in a different context. Which companies, which corporations actually respect viewpoint diversity? Well, our friends at Alliance Defending Freedom actually have a report out to discuss that. And joining us to discuss that is our friend Jerry Boyer, Forbes contributing editor of affluentinvestor.com and senior fellow in business economics at the Center for Cultural Leadership. He founded the influential economic think tank, the Allegheny Institute, and has lectured extensively at universities, businesses, and civics groups. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Ed, great to be with you. A real pleasure.
Well, it's a pleasure talking with you as well. And when we're talking about, you know, oftentimes we talk about corporate activism and corporate politics outside. When I'm talking about corporate politics, I'm not talking about politics inside the boardroom. That's a whole other topic. I'm talking about how they express themselves in politics. In fact, there's a story out today that Ron DeSantis in Florida has vetoed some funding that was for the Tampa Bay baseball team, I believe it was, for $35 million for a facility with some sort of, you can describe it even as corporate welfare spending down there, just a way to keep the baseball team happy. And canceled funding down there because the baseball team decided to get involved in gun control politics. And in Florida, you know, it's a contact sport down there. Politics is a contact sport. So I'm not even really talking about that. I'm talking about just the way that the corporations use their businesses in terms of promoting a specific and really singular point of view. And that's something that's come up a lot in the last couple of years.
Yeah, it really has. It's come up a lot in the sense that, you know, here we are in the spring, right, and things that were growing under the ground, root systems being established, suddenly spring up. And that's really what's happened with this phenomenon of the ideological capture of American boardrooms. Activists have been working on this really for a couple of decades and very aggressively for the past decade. And they're activists pretty much uniformly from the left, largely on two sets of issues. One is global warming, and the other is essentially, you know, sexual revolution, sexual identitarian politics, as we add L's and G's and B's and keep adding new categories. You know, that's really ramped up. And what's happened is conservatives, Christians, and just people who think corporations should stay out of it, which includes many liberals, essentially stayed out of this fight. They didn't show up at shareholder meetings. They weren't involved. They weren't maybe even tracking that it was going on. And now suddenly an entire infrastructure and a movement has occurred, and the diversity officers are coming from a certain point of view. The human relations officers are coming from a certain point of view. The board members have been chosen. And these corporations are uniformly, let's say almost 100%, uniformly coming down on the side of the sexual revolution. And we're surprised by that. But we shouldn't be, or at least anyone who is paying attention shouldn't be. The Alliance Defending Freedom got caught up in this because they were delisted by Amazon from the Amazon Smile program. If you don't know what that is, Amazon Smile program enables Amazon customers to say, hey, here's a charity that I like. And when you buy something on Amazon, they give, I think, 0.5% of the purchase to that charity you choose. And they had a broad range of charities. And then the Southern Poverty Law Center said, well, the ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom, is a hate group. And the Family Research Council is a hate group. And because the SPLPC had in the past identified genuine hate groups, like the KKK, It was just assumed that everyone they say is a hate group is a hate group, when in fact all ADF was saying is if somebody doesn't want to bake a cake for a gay wedding, same-sex wedding, they shouldn't be forced to. That's called hate. They're listed as a hate group, and they're thrown in the same outer darkness with the KKK and the Nazi Party, and they were canceled from the SMILE program. And ADF said, what's going on here? And they reached out to Amazon, and Amazon wasn't really interested. And they begin to notice that this was a pattern. It wasn't just an Amazon thing. It was a whole tech sector thing. And you know what? It's not just a tech sector thing. It's really publicly traded corporations, or at least the large ones. And they realized something needed to be done. They decided to do a survey that said, how are these companies doing on defending religious freedom and viewpoint diversity? And the answer is, in general, very badly.
Well, generally very badly. Again, we're talking with Jerry Boyer, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. And in large part, it's because you have already had, as you mentioned, the years of putting together this employee activist strategy, which is sometimes called ESG, which stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance I'm not even sure what you would say, strategies, I guess, that are designed to...
Yeah, there's really no noun. It's just the adjectives.
It's just the adjectives, right, Jerry? Yeah. I mean, I think it's supposed to be a strategy, right? It's sort of like a rating system that warns investors to not invest in particular companies that don't have a very narrow point of view and a very narrow activist stance on particular key issues. And so when you hear ESG, it sounds somewhat tame, but when it's in practice, it's actually very much a very restrictive, a very radical approach to working with investors that probably had its roots in what we called the BDS strategy, the BDS initiative that tried to force companies to divest in Israel, for instance.
Yeah, there was a lot of overlap early on between the BDS movement and the ESG movement. Now, eventually, ESGs figured out that this was really a non-starter for them. There was such backlash from the financial community against the anti-Israel sentiment that mostly that ESG movement said, okay, we're tired of trashing Israel. That's not really helping our cause much. So they kind of moved away from that. But basically the roots of this are in the United Nations and what's called sustainable investing. So it started as a United Nations committee. They came up with a set of criteria for what is sustainable investing. For a while, that was called SRI, socially responsible investing. Then it kind of changed its name to ESG. What it really amounts to is to say, let's look at our political and social desires, our wish list, and then say, one way or another, we're going to punish companies for not conforming to our political wish list. It's not a financial wish list. In other words, we're not talking about whether a company badly manages its finances or has too much debt or something like that, things that are relevant to returns. It's really pretty focused on, well, are they towing the line on the greenhouse gas emissions issue, or are they towing the line on diversity? Diversity being only skin deep in sexual identity, not viewpoint diversity. Early on, it was a lot of, we're not going to invest in you because you're bad. But at some point, they figured out that actually investing and showing up had more power than screening out and divesting. And so what they did is they bought shares and they showed up at annual meetings and they just little by little influenced things in a certain direction. That's how they won. They didn't win by divesting, screening, saying we don't want anything to do with you. They won by buying the shares and then using the voice.
And this is the reason why I want to get to what's going on at ADF, because this is actually it almost flips this on its head, not in terms of just picking the other agenda and saying, okay, now we're going to do the same thing, but for our agenda rather than the ESG agenda or the SRI agenda. ADF is actually looking at real diversity, real viewpoint diversity in this new index that they have, the Fortune 1000
viewpoint
list. the Viewpoint Diversity
Index, right?
Yeah, viewpointdiversityscore.org is where you can find this. You can look up a firm and see if it's been rated yet or not. But I mean, that's what this is the reason why I like what ADF is doing, is that they're not saying we're going to start punishing companies that don't adhere to our narrow viewpoint, our narrow agenda. They're just saying we're going to rate companies to see how much diversity of viewpoint they actually allow within their organizations.
Yes, and they're doing it objectively. So it's not, you know, how much conservatism do you tolerate? Do you have generally tolerant policies? But in our world right now, if you're for neutrality, you are treated as an extreme right winger. So kind of the debate is the left doesn't want neutrality, and the right and the center want neutrality. And I've talked to a lot of these companies, and I've also talked to the proxy services about this. And it's amazing how much you start to have a conversation with them. Well, you know, we're concerned about your viewpoint diversity. Oh, diversity, 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 diversity. You know, we mentioned diversity 700 times on our website. Yeah, you do. And it's really good that you don't discriminate against somebody because they're black or Latino. That's a really wonderful thing. And we certainly don't want people fired because they're gay. That would be a crazy way to run a business, to fire someone, you know, because of an issue like that. You fire someone because they're bad at their job. But you don't ever touch the diversity that's at the deepest core of people, which is their religion and politics. So we like that somebody can't get fired because they're gay. But why can't you also say that somebody who's a Baptist or a traditional Roman Catholic can't get fired because they're against gay marriage, right? Because the protections for the first one are very clearly outlined, and generally there's no protection mentioned for that second category.
We are speaking with Jerry Boyer, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. I should also mention that Jerry is the author of The Bush Boom and, more recently, The Free Market Capitalist Survival Guide. And, of course, you can find out more about this particular topic at viewpointdiversityscore.org, viewpointdiversityscore.org. And, Jerry, again, getting back to
the Bush Boom might be a little obsolete at this point.
Well, you know, it's good for historical purposes, though, Jerry. We got to promote it, at least, right?
New book, The Maker versus the Takers, that one is about a year and a half ago. That one might be a little
there
more current.
Yeah. That is not nostalgic at all. The Makers versus the Takers. Be sure to check that out as well. But the Bush Boom, you know, you have to have that at least on your shelf, right? Let's make sure that we have the basics here that people can.
It was right. I mean, the economy boomed until 2008, so I'm happy with the book. But
very well done, Jerry. But back to the ADF here. This is, to me, I think that this is something that it's too bad that it's necessary, right? Because really, honestly, if you're looking at this, the business of business is business, right? I mean, you know, I think it was Calvin Coolidge who said the business of America is business. But I mean, really, the business of business is business. I mean, this is an A equals A sort of thing, or it should be. Corporations come into existence so that they can have a return to their shareholders, not necessarily to where, you know, they can have their shareholders manipulated for particular political gains. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not a purist. I understand that, you know, corporations also work in the real world. And unfortunately, these days, the real world is increasingly polarized, and increasingly you have this sort of intolerance that is coming from every place, but seems to be more from the transcendent mainstream activists these days, which tend to be on the left, the progressives. And that is something that corporations really should eschew at all times. So honestly, if I'm looking at the ADF's viewpoint diversity score as an investor, if I was an investor, I don't have that kind of money, you know, Jerry, but if I was that kind of investor, I'd be looking at that and saying, well, I want to see which companies are healthy investments, because these are the companies that are not going to get crosswise on a political issue and end up doing damage to their customer base.
Right. Right. By the way, do you know how much you have to own in order to vote on these proxies or attend an annual meeting?
I would say just a single share. Yeah, just a single share.
Single share. That's all it takes. So you don't have to be rich. I can tell you that, having sat through the Disney shareholder meeting, if you know, let's have, you know, Abraham negotiating with God, you know, would 10 righteous show up? They didn't. I mean, if 10 Christians who own shares in Disney had logged on to that meeting and asked questions like, wait a minute, before we rush into this, we really think that you were right in the beginning to stay out of this bill, this parental rights and education mislabeled don't say gay. But we don't. Here's my point. It really doesn't take that much. For decades, one person would buy a share and show up. Maybe their issue was gay rights, or, you know, often a nun would show up and, you know, kind of speak out against Catholic. I know we're on Catholic radio. I like nuns. I just don't think that they're
right.
They're wonderful people, but I'm not sure that their economics is always, you know, sort of their best contribution to society. You know, I'm not sure that's their, you know, zone of expertise.
It's not their forte.
They would show up,
yes.
and they would, not their forte, nor the main calling. And they would show up and they would pull to the left. And it would be one or two or three people. So one share people who are middle class, lower middle class, I'm not rich either. So you don't have to be rich in order to own a share, in order to log on to the annual meeting, in order to make your voice heard.
Well, I think there's an old saying says half of life is just showing up. And you find
yes.
out very often that just the act of showing up does make a difference, especially when it comes to things like corporate shareholder meetings, or for that matter, going to committee meetings or anything else like that, going to your local school board meeting. We have found out just showing up to those can make it.
Look what's happened. Parents showing up to a school board meeting to talk about toxic critical race theory education, and they swayed things. And I'd say going to an annual meeting is like going to a school board meeting. When you go to an annual meeting of a corporation, you know how many people are in the room? 200, maybe 300. That's
something
how small
like that.
A group we're talking about that's steering the conversation. And maybe 20 are asking questions. That's how big your voice is if you use it. And we just came through it. We just had Alphabet, formerly known as Google, this week. You know, we had Facebook last week. We had Amazon last week. So we've had these annual meetings. And I can tell you there were some questions, but not a lot. Basically, groups that represent maybe 2% of the population were hyper-organized, and the rest of us were kind of asleep at the wheel. Now, I think we're awake now. We now know something has happened. Now, the question is, what are you going to do? Outrage at a distance, or just say, well, sell my, I don't want to own Amazon, or I don't want to own Apple because, you know, they're woke? Well, okay, maybe eventually you want to do that, but hey, why don't you use your voice first and see what happens?
Well, and again, I mean, it gets back to what you said at the very beginning. Initially, of course, the idea was with the activists was to divest, was to force divestment. And when you force divestment, you no longer have a voice. And I think that's a key point here, too. And it's not just in terms of investment, right? And we had a caller. Unfortunately, the caller dropped off the line, and the caller said, hey, you know, maybe we should, you know, get out of Amazon and stop using it. I mean, if you want to do that, there's no problem with that. If you want to
right.
patronize your local brick and mortar stores, your local brick and mortar stores will be very happy to see you show up. On the
sure.
other hand, some people really just have particular needs that can only be addressed through, you know, mail order, if you will, or catalog sales. Amazon is really just nothing more than a very large mail order / catalog type of company. And I don't want to tell people you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't go on Google to do a Google search. I mean, those types of things, I think, are very easy to say. And that type of disconnect is very easy to suggest. But in the real world, it becomes a lot more difficult. And you are basically penalizing yourself, and you're in some ways marginalizing yourself and your voice in being able to discuss these sorts of things. And,
you know,
well,
I can admire Simon Stylites.
Yeah.
You know, and the Desert Fathers, I can admire them, and the Hermits, but in some ways I maybe admire an Augustine more, who got into the
right.
matters of state and transformed a culture and created a new civilization. So if somebody feels that they're morally bound so that they can't invest in Apple because you can download pornography on an iPhone, and you can. So somewhere in your Apple dividend, somewhere in there is pornography revenues. Now, I don't think biblically, my understanding of moral theology is that you're responsible for your deeds. You're not responsible for the deeds of other people that you have commercial relationships with. So that's not, you know, owning Apple is not the same as buying or producing pornography. And I think Catholic moral theory has been really clear on this,
yes,
you know, the difference,
yes,
between performing and participating or, you know, et cetera. But nevertheless, I understand that people have a conscience issue and Amazon does something that they don't like. If they have a conscience issue, don't use Amazon. That's Paul's clear on that in the meat sacrifice to idols. Or you can screen it out of your portfolio. And, you know, here's a commercial, there's a Catholic fund, Ave Maria, that, you know, screens those things out. But that is an individual moral conscience. It's not immoral to invest in these companies. So that's up to you. All I'm saying is prudentially, when you say I'm not going to invest, you are decreasing your influence rather than increasing your influence. So I would say my default is invest and then engage, and then, you know, leave the rest up to God. Well, they won't listen. Well, I don't know whether they'll listen. Missionaries went to various places around the world and they shared the gospel, and a lot of times they got killed. But they delivered the message. That's already a success. You won't get killed at an annual meeting. The worst that'll happen is they'll say, oh, that question is not pertinent to the meeting, and they'll cut it off. What's going to cut your head off? So delivering the message, I think, is an act of faithfulness in itself. But yes, if somebody has a conscience issue, I would say if you don't believe you can eat meat sacrifice to idols or own Amazon stock or the S&P 500 or whatever, if you don't believe you should, then you shouldn't. But for the rest of us, which is probably the majority of people, don't waste your voice.
I think that's great, and I think you're correct in really tying this back to the differences between the hermits, the monks who retreated from the world into prayer, who were called to do that, right? I mean, that was,
yes,
a calling, and God called them to do that. And it's a you know, beautiful sacrifice that they still make to this day to do that, but for the most part, and we just got done hearing about the Great Commission last weekend, is that for the most part, we're called to go out in the world and to deliver the gospel message and the message of truth. And that means exactly what you're talking about, is that you can't retreat from the world. You have to actually go out and you have to be active and you have to find ways to do this. And one of the great ways to do this, and just to bring it back here as we wrap things up, is to take a look at ADF's Viewpoint Diversity Score. ViewpointDiversityScore.org is where you can find this to find out which companies are doing a good job and which companies might need a little bit more of a push. And Jerry Boyer, I'll let you wrap this up with the last 30 seconds.
Just look at what's in your 401k. Look at those companies, and probably something will pop out that's been in the news. Or you can go to the ADF and the Viewpoint Diversity and look them up and see how they're doing. And then there's something called the Investor Relations Department, and you just send them an email. I'm a shareholder. I don't like what you're doing. I'd like to talk about it. Also, on that Investor Relations page, you can find out when the next annual meeting is, and you can log on to that, and you can speak up there as well. It's not that complicated.
Jerry Boyer, who is the author of The Makers Versus the Takers, by the way, as well
thank
as
you.
The Free Market Capitalist Survival Guide. Thank you so much for being with us today, Jerry. Always great talking with you, Jerry. You can
and
find
you.
Out more again at ViewpointDiversityScore.org, ViewpointDiversityScore.org. Thank you very much, Jerry Boyer. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters, the sponsor of our studio line, is hiring today with several positions throughout the U.S. Visit relevantradio.com/forester to learn more about how you can find your vocation with COF, an Illinois Life Insurance Society, not licensed in all states.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 30 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I know we just ran the spot regarding the free book, Father Rocky's new free book, The Memorari Moment. Today's the last day. This is the last week that you can get your name in for the, a free book, Father Rocky's free book, The Memorari Moment. Our world desperately needs Mary's help right now, so please join us today at relevantradio.com/moment with this new free book to learn more about this prayer and why praying it right now can change history. Listeners and readers Mark and Terry Coller in Minnesota wrote to us about the Memorari Moment. Woven with, remarkably with easy-to-read anecdotes of Father Rocky's delightful Catholic upbringing, the book helps us understand the power of saying the Memorari in these challenging times. It is a simple prayer with great power. May this book bring people closer to our mother and the power that she can have when we turn to her on a regular basis. Final copies are going fast. Act right now, today. relevantradio.com/moment. That's where you find that, relevantradio.com/moment. And one of the areas I think that we turn to our mother most often is in times of conflict and war. And of course, the world is watching in horror as Europe is being convulsed in yet another war, this time between Russia and Ukraine. We've just gone 100 days since the invasion of Ukraine. And here to discuss that with us is Dr. Daniel Kempton. He's the Vice President of Academic Affairs at Franciscan University of Steubenville. He holds a PhD in political science from the University of Illinois at Champaign. He was a Fulbright Scholar at Rhodes University in South Africa and again at Tver State University in Russia. He has published many scholarly works, including on the former Soviet Union and its involvement in Southern Africa. Dr. Kempton, thanks for coming on today with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
So we're at, I think it's 102 days now since the invasion. It's just after the 100th day. And I would say that, first off, people are probably looking back now and a little surprised that it's still going on. I think when this war first kicked off, people didn't expect it to last more than maybe a week or 10 days. They thought that Russia was going to quickly overwhelm Ukraine. That hasn't been the case.
No, I think there are a lot of comparisons to recent conflicts like the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq, in which one side had clear technological as well as significant personnel advantages over the others, and the expectation was very quick. We went into this thinking that the Russian army was a large and technologically advanced force, but what we learned fairly quickly is the technologically advanced part of it was not very large, and the large part of it was not very advanced.
Well, I think as long as we're going to focus on the Russian military, I think that there was a great deal of overestimation in terms of their competence in battle tactics, but also in logistics. And this shouldn't really be a difficult logistics war for Russia. This is right across their own border. So it has been surprising in the first 100 days to see just how poorly they operated in that sense. And we haven't really seen the Russian army in action in a large sense. Maybe Chechnya would be one instance, but really since Afghanistan, and I think even in Afghanistan, the battle tactics were pretty clear, and they seem to be pretty competent at that stage in 1980. But it's really a shock, I think, to see how poorly they're handling tactics and logistics.
Yeah, I think they were greatly overconfident, and to be honest, most of the world was overconfident along with them. I mean, we thought that because of the numerical superiority, the technological advantages, they would advance quickly, but that meant their planning was all based on it moving very quickly, which it didn't. And let's be honest, no one thought the Ukrainian capabilities or commitments would be this fierce and this successful. There's a lot of things that surprised many experts, myself included, about the world reaction, the Ukrainian reaction, as well as Russian capabilities.
Well, so let's talk about the Ukrainian capabilities and their reaction. I think you're right. I mean, at the very beginning, you had Western leaders offering Volodymyr Zelensky an escape route so that he could set up basically a government in exile. He refused it. People look at that and are critical of that. But I think if you went in with the assumptions that not just the United States, but European countries had, that their intel services told them about Russian capabilities, that is, I mean, think that was a reasonable strategy to at least offer Zelensky. And I don't think anybody expected them to be able to mount a home defense based on the size and use of their own military.
No, they've performed very admirably and with incredible determination. I mean, there are obviously some things from a Catholic perspective about President Zelensky that I don't admire, that I disagree with him on sort of social issues. But one yes. cannot deny the success of his rallying of the Ukrainian people. I mean, the term Churchillian has been used, and I think is an accurate one. He has rallied a people. He's become the man of the moment in a way no one really expected. I mean, for someone with a background as a comedian and considered a political neophyte and lightweight, he has just outperformed all expectations. The people have rallied. The degree to which Ukrainians have taken pride. I mean, this is a country that suffered from a lot of problems post-independence, including a lot of corruption, a lot of disorganization, a lot of political turmoil. And this has just all been turned around in a very short period of time.
Yeah. Well, also, I'm sorry, go ahead, Dr. Kempton.
I would also say the world has come to their aid in a way that's absolutely stunned. I mean, I was anticipating the Germans threatening to shut down the pipeline, but not really doing it, Nord Stream 2. Not only have they shut down the pipeline, but they've begun a rearmament process. The Polish government has been absolutely historic in its support of the Ukrainians. And again, so much in war is unpredictable, and this has been incredibly unpredictable in many ways.
Well, Dr. Kempton, that leads me to the third point that I wanted to make, which was that NATO has been a little surprising. You've already started this. You're talking about Germany's response being surprisingly robust. I'm not terribly surprised about Poland and the Baltic states being as robust as they've been, because they're the ones that are closest to the threat. But now you've got Finland and Sweden that are applying for NATO membership. Sweden's been famously neutral for centuries, or at least, you know, professed to be neutral for centuries. Now, both Finland and Sweden were NATO partners, if you will. They cooperated with NATO. They did joint operations or joint exercises with NATO on a fairly regular basis, but they wouldn't allow NATO bases to be established in their countries. And that has changed. That's a dramatic change. And I think that at the beginning, the question would be not whether NATO would muscle up and unite, but just how quickly it would fall apart if the Russians decided to invade and quickly achieve their objectives.
Yeah, no, it's been literally stunning to me, and it's also a unique opportunity for the West that the world together has now seen the threat from tyrannical regimes.
Yes,
and again, there are things Putin has done that one may like, but at the same time, he has been a killer in terms of his press, in terms of his political opposition. And on a global scale, this is not the first time he's done this. And this is why I think we were surprised, because he was very successful previously in Georgia, previously in Transnistria, previously in the Ukraine, in taking the Crimea and taking in 2014 parts of Ukraine. But he has been prudent in backing off before, and the world has sort of let him run his course in a mild policy of appeasement. So the fact that he did not stop short and that the world did not appease are both rather surprising. But in terms of the opportunity, I think it's an important point to realize Turkey, or Turkey, as I think they're now going to pronounce it, is actually serious in its challenge of Sweden's and Finland's application to NATO. And the U.S. needs to step forward. I mean, this is an administration in the U.S. that claims it's great at discussions, at negotiations, at rallying allies. We should be in the middle of this mix trying to persuade Turkey that this is a time to let them in, because I'm afraid that Turkey may do for not for Russia's reasons, but may actually block those admissions. And it has a lot to do with their Sweden's support for the Kurdish opposition forces.
Right. Right. That's very interesting, too, because people, I've talked with people who say, well, we should just kick Turkey out of NATO or Turkey. I agree with that. I just saw that the other day, too, that they want to change the spelling and the pronunciation. We'll stick with Turkey for the moment. But Turkey's already providing strategic support, really, for NATO's position there. They're keeping the Russian Navy out of the Black Sea through their control of the Bosphorus. And we really can't afford at the moment to just simply say, well, we'd rather have Finland and Sweden rather than Turkey. We, at this point, as troublesome as a partner as Turkey has been, we actually really need them at this point, and I think that Erdogan really understands that now, too.
Yeah, I think you're precisely right. I mean, Finland and Sweden don't give us huge strategic advantage, so from a purely self-interested motive, which cannot be our only one, but from a purely self-interested motive, controlling the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles controls Russia's access to the global seas and prevents it from becoming a more major international naval power. It's actually put significant pressures on it during this conflict. Turkey was also very strategic in its quiet support for the U.S. in both Afghanistan and Iraq. So although we see the world differently at times, although we're troubled friends at times, they've been very important friends also.
I think part of what Turkey wants here is the F-35s, right? They want the full platform for the F-35s. We've been fighting over that for a couple of years. I also think that they want the Kurdish activists that Sweden is sheltering at the moment. But I agree with you that the White House probably needs to take the lead on this. I'm not necessarily sure that they're not. You know, I'm not necessarily the greatest fan of the current administration, but after a couple of weeks of stubborn incrementalism here, I think that as you know, President Biden's own political opponent Mitch McConnell put it, I think he's been on the right path.
Yeah.
The question here is whether you can get them to cut a deal, and so it may be an issue of getting to the right formula, but it's going to be tricky for any president to navigate this one.
Yeah, but I do think it is our role to do it. And
yep,
the way Turkey is playing this, I don't believe its opposition is set in stone. I think they see this as a valuable moment, and we need to cut the best deal we can to get this done. And that may require some concessions. I mean, there are parts of the PKK that are functionally terrorist organizations, and we have to look at the individual cases and work through the particulars of it. But those are the kind of issues we've got to work on quickly to get things done from the Ukraine. I think in many cases I agree with your assessment of the Biden administration that it's eventually done things the right way, but it's just taken time. And they seem to hem and haw, and they say no before they say yes. And, you know, our European allies in many ways have been leading on this and providing aid more quickly and making decisions. I also think we're a little too terrified by Russian threats. There's no logical reason that providing Ukraine tanks and artillery won't provoke Russia, but providing older MiG fighter planes would provoke Russia. Yet restraint, I think, allows Putin to manipulate us a little bit.
I think it does too, and I think it's part of the old paradigm of conventional deterrence. I think that the fact that his military has, at least the conventional military, has been shown to be so completely ineffective has really eliminated some of that deterrent factor. Now, we're speaking with Dr. Daniel Kempton, Vice President of Academic Affairs at Franciscan University of Steubenville. We're going to come back after the break. We're going to take your calls. We're going to continue this conversation about Ukraine. I want to talk about what we do from this point. What type of settlement does Dr. Kempton think will actually result from this conflict? That's an important question because it helps to set our policy, what we want to have happen. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Now.
On Relevant Radio.
Right now.
On Relevant Radio.
It's 48 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Speaking with Daniel Kempton, Vice President of Academic Affairs at Franciscan University of Steubenville, and talking about the conflict in Ukraine. We've kind of covered what's come up to this point, Dr. Kempton. Now we're going to have to start taking a look at where we go from here. We've signed a $40 billion aid package, which primarily military aid to Ukraine. There's probably going to be more coming along, although maybe probably not that much, but there'll be incrementally more going down the line the longer this drags out. As you mentioned, Europe has been sending aid over. We're still trying to dance around what type of weapon systems we will send, that we won't send, etc. But at some point here, this thing is going to get into almost a block-by-block slug, especially in the southeastern part of the country, the Donbas. And you can argue that it's already there. I mean, it's not quite stasis. Right now the Russians are making some incremental gains, but they were doing that in the north, too, and ended up stalling out. At some point, you have to bring a conflict to an end. Ukrainians are saying they're going to fight until they get Russia off of every single square inch of Ukraine. Russia is saying that they're not going to leave, period, end of story. They're there to liberate these territories. Is there any room right now for a settlement, or does this have to be fought out to a conclusion on the battlefield?
I think there always has to be room, and that countries have to be trying. At the same time, I'm not terribly optimistic. We're at a point in the conflict where both sides are making the argument rather persistently that it's a war of attrition that they can win. I mean, Putin has repeatedly argued in the Russian press that although this is costing Russia more in terms of lives and economic health and finances, that in the long run this means more to them, and the West doesn't have much staying power, so he expects the West to eventually back down, leave Russia alone and without, or leave Ukraine alone, and without Ukrainian backing, he will eventually win it. Russia will prevail. Conversely, the Ukrainians are arguing, you know, we have a commitment to this long term, and, you know, we've already paid this much in blood. There's no way we're going to cave in and give up now. So it's a very delicate situation, and one I'm not optimistic about being solved quickly. That said, I would argue that the West should be putting out, we should be working with our allies to the greatest extent possible with the Ukrainian regime to signal to the Russian people and even to Putin, although I don't expect Putin to take the deal, what an acceptable deal could look like. And there are elements of that that I think are fairly clear to us already. The first element of it is there must be a return of the territory taken by Russia in this war. And that point, I think, Zelensky is correct, that we can't let this war have gained them territory. The second right. thing I think the West needs to make clear and insist on is that, look, he did this partly because Putin was angry about the expansion of what the West, of NATO, into Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, into Poland, and he wanted to stop it at Ukraine. I think a appropriate ending to this would be the admission of Sweden and Finland to show that this whole thing was counterproductive, that by trying to prevent a Western threat and using force against your neighbors, you actually increase the Western presence along your borders. Now, that said, we have to make it appealing to the Russians. So what has to be offered in back has to be some sort of normalization, that sanctions would be rapidly, quickly lifted, More controversial than that, I think, would be the issue of Ukraine itself joining NATO. Now, one could say, well, you know, there weren't plans for NATO to accept Ukraine. We actually danced with that possibility in the past and gave it up. And maybe we should have accepted them in 2008 when we hinted that we would. But that could be something that you could throw to Putin, and then he could claim, well, gee, I wanted them to not join NATO, and they're not. It's also possible to draw a distinction between the territory that Russia took in 2014, particularly Crimea, and the present land grab. And the reason I make that argument is Crimea is kind of a funny case in that it had more Russians than Ukrainians to begin with. It has more Tartars than either Russians or Ukrainians.
Right.
It's been handed back and forth, and was most recently went back to Ukraine when it was part of the Soviet Union as a gift from then Soviet General Secretary Nikita Khrushchev. So you could, you know, you have to think of what could they get, but it has to look like a serious offer, but at the same time, and what I would hope is, I'm very dubious that Putin will take any sort of reasonable deal, but it has to look like, to those who are waiting for him to pass or are trying to oust him, that, look, there is a deal to be had if we can get beyond Putin.
I think that's a great point, Dr. Kempton. Let's go to the calls. Let's go to the phones really quickly. We have a caller that's been waiting for a bit. Nick in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Welcome to the conversation.
Good afternoon. My question is, what do you make of the simultaneous arming of Ukraine in the introduction of disarmament legislation here in the West? And it seems strange to me that we're doing kind of that double standard while also kind of backing away from international talks, like you said earlier. To me, that just kind of signals a red flag. What's your take on that?
Nick, thanks for your call. I actually think that these are two separate issues. I know that I'm probably sympathetic with you on both of these, but I think that gun control legislation in the United States is probably a bit of a separate issue than what we're doing in Ukraine. Of course, it is. I mean, we're sending over a lot of small arms there so that Ukrainian civilians can defend themselves, Dr. Kempton. I'm not sure if you want to comment on that or not, but it's certainly an interesting momentary contrast here in the United States.
Yeah, it is an interesting one because a lot of the weapons the Ukrainians were initially defending their country with were sort of handguns and local weapons, and actually weapons that were not even as capable as AR-15s and assault rifles.
Right.
Which came in very handy. But I don't see a direct relationship there. One issue I think that is interesting is when we talk about global disarmament, keep in mind we helped negotiate the deal and even push the Ukrainians to give up their nuclear weapons at the collapse of the Soviet Union. And as part of that agreement, the Bucharest Agreement, the U.S. and Russia both agreed to respect Ukraine's territorial integrity. So we've got to be a bit more careful what we say and do, because, I mean, Ukrainians have to be looking at this precedent and saying, boy, were we stupid to trust the world and give up our nukes, you know.
Not just Ukraine either. I mean, there are other countries that are looking at that and saying, we're not going to give up our nukes for anything, because clearly these agreements don't matter a bit to either of the two participants, Russia or the United States. Again, we're speaking with Dr. Daniel Kempton. I want to bring one other thing up here. We've got a couple of minutes left. I think that I really liked your approach on framing a deal, because I think that that's a really realistic way to settle the conflict. Even if Putin doesn't listen to it, there are people in Russia who might be looking to 86 Putin to get out of this and to get back to a more normal economic status, and that would be that would allow them a lot more leverage, I think, in order to move forward. But here's the problem for Volodymyr Zelensky: is that you really have the Michael Collins conundrum, right? Michael Collins, of course, the Irish freedom fighter who signed the treaty that sort of led to partition and ended up paying with his life for that, even if it was the smart thing to do, even if it allowed for some normality there. I mean, I think that that might be something that certainly weighs on Zelensky's mind. Yeah. He may not have the leverage. He may not have the leeway to make that kind of a deal anymore.
Yeah, I think he does have the ability to press the West to get Russia to give up the land it took this time around. And I think I wouldn't blame him for doing that, and I certainly wouldn't want to leave the precedent of Russia gaining again through military force, because this had become a pattern, but usually the pattern is Russia intervenes, it takes a whole bunch of territory, then it backs off to what it actually thinks it can hold. That was in both Georgia, Transnistria, Moldova, you know, South Ossetia in Georgia. So we've seen that pattern before. This was a bit different, and I'm not sure if he intended it to be as complete, but it sure evolved into that fairly quickly.
Certainly did, and it certainly means that there are a lot fewer options for a settlement that both countries can and both leaders can live with, both figuratively and perhaps even literally. Dr. Daniel Kempton, Vice President of Academic Affairs at Franciscan University of Steubenville, thank you so much for being with us. Stay tuned, folks, because coming up next is the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.